Good evening. 56 Iranians killed as millions show up to mourn a general who Trump says got what he deserved.
He's been called a monster, and he was a monster. And he's no longer a monster. He's dead.
And the Secretary of Defense says he's ready to talk with the enemy as an earthquake rocks Puerto Rico. Where's the president? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. Crowds forced into narrow confines with no exits panicked at a funeral for a top Iranian general slain in a U.S. airstrike on Tuesday. Iranian news says at least 56 people were killed and more than 200 were injured as a multitude thronged the procession. And as grief-stricken Iranians called for revenge, the United States continued to reinforce its own positions in the region. U.S. embassies and consulates around the world issued security alerts for Americans. The U.S. Air Force launched a drill with 52 fighter jets in Utah just days after President Donald Trump threatened to hit 52 sites in Iran, one for each of the hostages taken at the U.S. embassy in a 1979 incident. Hossein Salami, the new leader of the Revolutionary Guard, addressed a crowd of supporters gathered at the coffin in a central square in Kernan. He vowed to avenge Soleimani. He said, "We tell our enemies that we will retaliate, but if they take another action, we will set ablaze the places that they like and are passionate about." At the White House on Tuesday, President Trump reiterated his defense of the strike that killed Soleimani on Friday at the Baghdad airport.
This was an attack based on what they did. We weren't the first one out. He killed an American. Now two people are dead from the same attack and some people very badly wounded. And that was one of his smaller endeavors. You look over his past. His past, he's been called a monster, and he was a monster. And he's no longer a monster. He's dead. And that's a good thing for a lot of countries. And he was planning a very big attack and a very bad attack for us and other people. And we stopped him. And I don't think anybody can complain about it. I don't hear too many people other than politicians who are trying to win the presidency. Those are the ones that are complaining. But I don't hear anybody else complaining.
According to reports, Soleimani was in Baghdad on the return leg of a trip to Damascus to meet with Saudi Arabian officials in a bid to reduce tensions between the two regional powers. Sources in Iran have been telling the media that the United States was aware of Soleimani's peace mission and had given their approval. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Mark Esby said the U.S. doesn't want war with Iran and is open to negotiations.
As we defend our people and interests, let me reiterate that the United States is not seeking a war with Iran, but we are prepared to finish one. We are seeking a diplomatic solution, but first, this will require Iran to de-escalate. It will require the regime to come to the table with the goal of preventing further bloodshed. And it will require them to cease their malign activities throughout the region. As I've said, we are open to having this discussion with them, but we are just as prepared to deliver a forceful response to defend our interests. Finally, the American people should know that their safety is in the hands of the strongest, most capable military in the world. The men and women of our armed forces should know that we are standing with them and will continue to support them as they meet and overcome today's threats from malign actors, including Iran and its proxy militias. Our partners should know that we remain committed to our strategic priorities in the Middle East, deterring Iranian bad behavior, sustaining the enduring defeat of ISIS, and supporting Iraq as it becomes a strong and independent nation. And the architects of terror should know that we will not tolerate attacks against America's people and interests, and will exercise our right to self-defense should that become necessary once again. With that, I'll open this up for some questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I just wanted to clarify one thing. You said earlier that the U.S. continues to engage ISIS in Syria. Has the anti-ISIS campaign in Syria been affected at all by this? And then secondly, there seems to be continued confusion among Iraqi officials about this draft letter. There was a televised appearance by Mahdi earlier today in which he sort of laid out what he said was a signed letter that the Iraqis got. Those are his words. And he suggested that another letter should be sent. What have you done and are you continuing to do to clear up what you said yesterday was a mistake?
Our policy has not changed. We are not leaving Iraq. And a draft unsigned letter does not constitute a policy change. And there is no signed letter, to the best of my knowledge. I've asked the question. So there may be people trying to create confusion, but we should focus on this much. What I've said a few times now, our policy has not changed. We are in Iraq, and we are there to support Iraqi forces and the Iraqi government become a strong, independent, and prosperous country.
And in Syria, the ISIS in Syria?
Okay. I've gotten no report from a commander saying that we've had a material impact on our ability to engage ISIS along with our SDF partners.
Jennifer? To follow up on Lita's question, what if the Iraqis don't want you to stay? If the prime minister says you need to go, will U.S. troops pull out? And also, NATO allies are pulling out. Why aren't U.S. troops pulling out?
So we'll take all those one step at a time. There's a few procedural mechanisms, hurdles, if you will, that the Iraqi government would need to go through. We remain in constant contact with them on that. I think it's fair to say that many Iraqis recognize the strategic importance of our partnership with them. Whether it's training and advising their military to become more effective on the field of battle, or it's working together with them to defeat ISIS coalition. I think the vote the other day shows the support of most Iraqis for our presence in the country. As you know, most Kurds and most Sunnis did not show, and those Shias who did vote, and many of them voted at the threat of their own lives by Shia militia groups. Even in the last few days, we still see Iraqis on the streets protesting their government due to corruption and the malign influence of Iran. So those sentiments, those feelings have not gone away. So I think at the end of the day, working with the Iraqi people, you'll find that our presence is important for both their country, ours.
Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, the letter he referred to is from a Marine, U.S. Marine officer that seemed to imply the U.S. was preparing to leave after the Iraqi Congress voted in a non-binding resolution to demand the U.S. exit the country. There are about 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, with several thousand on their way to the region. Meanwhile, in London, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed the House of Commons. He said Trump's actions endanger British citizens and are supported by Prime Minister Boris Johnson for self-serving reasons.
Could he tell us where the Prime Minister is? And what is he doing that's so much more important than addressing Parliament on the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani? An extremely dangerous and aggressive act that risks starting yet another deadly war in the Middle East. On Friday, I sent the Prime Minister a letter posing a series of questions. He has not answered any of them. Instead, today, he's hiding behind his Defence Secretary. Isn't the truth, Mr. Speaker, that he's scared to stand up to President Trump because he's hitched his wagon to the prospect of a toxic Trump trade deal? Instead, Mr. Speaker, at this highly dangerous moment, we find the government giving cover and even expressing sympathy for what is widely regarded as an illegal act because they're so determined to keep in with President Trump. This assassination puts British troops and civilians, as well as the people of the region, in danger. Mr. Speaker, as the Secretary of State for Defence will confirm, I've long spoken out against the Iranian government's human rights record, including when he and I visited Iran together in 2014. This is not a question of Soleimani's actions or record on the region. Whatever the record of any state official, the principle and the law is that we don't go around assassinating foreign leaders. Without the clear demonstration of an immediate threat, it is illegal.
The trade deal he was referring to is a Trump offer to Britain if it keeps to its Brexit timetable. In the United States, the weekend saw snap anti-war protests held in 80 cities and attended by thousands. Kathy Kelly is a peace activist who has visited the Middle East many times. She says protests can stop a war.
We have to remember that the world came so close in the build-up to the shock and awe bombing, to stopping that war before it started. And so I think there is a chance that not just in the United States, but worldwide, linking together, people can raise the deplorable record the United States has had in being so lethally meddlesome in Iran and Iraq, and also make connections with who does benefit, and that's mainly the weapon-making companies.
And there was a large anti-war movement back in the early 2000s that contributed, I guess, to the U.S. leaving Iraq and Afghanistan. What happened to that movement, and why wasn't it there this time, or is it there?
That movement wasn't so present before the United States built up toward that war. It was a longer buildup. But, I mean, I was going back and forth to Iraq to break the economic sanctions because we felt that was such a violation afflicting children, mainly children. And we couldn't get one word in the United States media. We couldn't get hardly a university professor to let us talk to their students. But in spite of that fact, no media coverage, there was a massive outpouring. And I think it was because people just realized how foolish and wrongful it would be. So I think that sense of outrage is there. I mean, just on 2 days' notice in Chicago, and it's a hard city in which to turn out big numbers, but there were about 800, somebody just told me today, and he was a reporter, he thought there were actually 1,000 people out. I didn't know most of the people that were there. The challenge now is to really widen out the coalition building, the faith-based groups and the traditional peace groups and the newly forming groups and the groups that are more perhaps invested generally in single issue. I think if we can all recognize that we don't stand a chance to address any of our issues as long as the Pentagon keeps on plundering our resources and pouring our resources into destroying other people's lands.
You mentioned sanctions that were used against Iraq back in the 1990s and early 2000s. The president has made a threat of sanctions again against Iraq.
Well, Paul, if I have the president's wording right, he said that they would impose sanctions that were like nothing Iraq had ever seen before, would be worse. Well, the last round, I mean, you can check out Joy Gordon, Harvard University Press, cost the lives of over 500,000 children. And I believe that's just counting the ones under age five. Some would dispute those statistics. But so, well, what if they're inflated by double? 250,000 children, those lives should have been snuffed out. I saw those children in the hospitals, and they were wasting away. They looked like wizened up little old men. Their eyes were huge. Their mothers were sorrowful. We kept on hearing, leish, leish, why? I remember being in an emergency room during the shock and awe bombing. And at that point, doctors were performing needed surgeries when they didn't even have anesthetics. And I was sitting next to a woman, and she was just convulsive with sobs. And I could hear her, I could make out, she was saying, how I tell him, what I say. And then I realized that it was her nephew in the emergency room, and surgeons were going to have to amputate both his arms at the shoulders. But she needed to tell him she was now his only surviving relative. And when he came to consciousness and the surgeon told him what had happened, that he had no more arms, that's all he told him. Little Ali Abbas said, will I always be this way? And I think that must be our question. Will we always be this way?
My word. So if there was war with Iran, for example, not beyond sanctions, there would be what they call collateral damage, the euphemism, but that means civilians getting hurt and killed in this way, in this manner.
Well, assuredly, and, you know, geographically, we can't even begin to imagine all the different places where hideous and gruesome conflict could break out. It's a long history of the United States meddling in the affairs of Iran and Iraq in ways that are lethal and unlawful and brutal. And if the people in that part of the world say, we've got to get this crowd out of our land, who could blame them?
Wag the dog. As some people have said that President Trump is doing this to take away attention from impeachment.
Well, you know, on a much smaller scale, I certainly thought that when President Clinton ordered the Desert Fox bombing in Iraq, and I happened to be there during that one too,
Everybody, just even the reporters, were saying, well, you know, that was kind of wag the dog. It seemed like President Clinton wanted to distract away from an impeachment trial. But these are higher stakes in terms of what the president is calling for. It's amazing to me that Republicans and the Pentagon can seem to, at any measure, in any measure, stick with him. Would he do it? We're talking about somebody whose analytical capacities and historical knowledge are quite limited. I'm not sure he could even figure out how to wag the dog.
Kathy Kelly is a peace activist who's made many visits to the Middle East where she's observed war and its aftermath. And journalist Reese Ehrlich, who has also traveled widely in the Middle East, says no matter what Trump claims, Iran is merely a regional power whose military reach comes nowhere close to the United States and is no threat to Americans.
Iran is certainly not a threat to the people of the United States. That's a myth that's being pushed not only by the Trump administration, but by previous Democratic and Republican administrations as well. Supposedly, Iran has a nuclear weapon or could be building a nuclear weapon. It's got supports for terrorist groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and so on. That's the argument. In fact, Iran certainly wants to expand its power in the region, but it's not something that is a threat to people in the United States. The U.S. policy doesn't care at all about human rights violations in Iran, of which there are plenty. It's interested in getting rid of the government and installing a pro-U.S. regime like we had under the Shah prior to 1979. So the U.S. people have no interest in protecting the oil profits of U.S. companies that would benefit from that policy. We should be opposing any efforts by the U.S. to attack Iran or Iraq or any of the other countries in the region. Trump was elected as a candidate who would end the endless wars, and he's in fact increased the wars and increased the number of troops stationed in the Middle East.
Who is this guy, the General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed? Who is he?
He was a high-ranking official in the Revolutionary Guards and the head of the Quds Force, which was kind of a combination of, Delta Special Forces and CIA in the United States. They were the troops fighting or advising people in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon. And he was considered a terrorist by the United States because he was effectively fighting the United States. The U.S. defines a terrorist as anybody who uses violence that the U.S. doesn't like. In fact, he wasn't doing anything more than what liberation groups do around the world in fighting, taking on the fight against military and political people that you don't like. Now, to be fair and to be honest, he was also widely hated by some folks in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq. There were Iranian-backed militias who opened fire on peaceful protesters as recently as a few months ago. In Iran, when there were mass protests, there was very harsh crackdowns on them by the Iranian government. And that's the sort of thing that Soleimani and his cohorts supported.
And that's journalist Reese Ehrlich. You're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday he has the votes to start President Donald Trump's impeachment trial as soon as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi releases the documents, winning support from GOP senators to postpone a decision on calling witnesses. McConnell also put some daylight between the Senate and Trump's angry tweet over the weekend that threatened to bomb Iranian cultural sites. He says the senators are not war criminals and it's time for House Speaker Pelosi to act.
The House argued that this was an emergency, they needed to act quickly, that the president was such, apparently, from their point of view, such a danger to the country that they needed to really rush this through. And then they sat on the papers now for 3 weeks. I hope that'll end this week. I understand there's considerable discomfort among Senate Democrats, some of them expressing that to some of you over the continued delay in sending it on over. I wanted to touch on a couple of other things. There was some discussion in the last few days and related to the Iraq episode that we're experiencing now about the appropriateness of targets. I want to associate myself with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State with regard to the appropriateness of cultural sites being targeted. That is not appropriate.
In a dueling news conference, Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer defended Pelosi as forcing the Senate to act on an impeachment trial.
The Speaker has said all along that she wanted to see the arena in which she was playing when it came to a trial so she could appoint impeachment managers. Now it's becoming clear that Mitch McConnell wants to do everything he can to avoid a fair trial, so she has some idea of what's happened. But let me say this. By not sending the articles immediately, she's already accomplished two things which we fully support. One, Mitch McConnell couldn't do what some thought he might want to do, right before Christmas or after Christmas, just dismiss. And second, in the last 2 weeks, there's been a cascade of evidence that bolsters the case, strongly bolsters the case for witnesses and documents. So now we have a greater feel for where we're headed. And Speaker Pelosi, I have a great faith in the decision that she will make. But she's accomplished a great deal already. And if you doubt that, ask any one of the Republicans. Not whether they'd support the kick the can down the road, not the whether they'd support the duck, but whether they'd support witnesses and documents. They're afraid to say yes because they know Donald Trump will be furious at them. They're afraid to say no because they know their voters, their constituents would be furious at them. They're stuck. We will not let them avoid the vote. They can delay it. They can't avoid it.
McConnell says he knows he now has the votes to bypass, for now anyway, Democratic demands for new testimony as he launches the third impeachment trial in the nation's history on his preferred terms. The trial could begin this week if Pelosi sends the articles of impeachment to the Senate. She's set to meet late Tuesday with her leadership team. And Puerto Rico's governor, Wanda Vasquez, declared a state of emergency and activated the National Guard on Tuesday after a series of earthquakes. The biggest was a magnitude 6.4, the most powerful to strike the Caribbean island in 102 years. Vasquez says the quakes killed at least one person, provoked a protective power outage across the entire island, and cut off drinking water to 300,000 customers. Seismologist John Bellini of the United States Geological Survey says the rare South Island quake should not cause a tidal wave, but was big enough to shake houses off their foundations.
Shortly before 4:30 a.m. Local time in Puerto Rico, there was a magnitude 6.4 earthquake just off the southwest coast. Since then, there's been numerous aftershocks, large enough to be felt, and many more that have not been felt. We do know that there was some damage on the island, and we do have reports of one casualty so far.
And how big was that earthquake?
The earthquake that happened this morning was a magnitude 6.4.
Wow, that's pretty big, isn't it?
It's a fairly large earthquake. It has also had several aftershocks in the magnitude 5.5 to 5.6 range.
It's happening out to sea. It's not actually happening in Puerto Rico itself.
They're just off the coast, just a mile or two off the coast. Most of these aftershocks and earthquakes have been occurring.
And is Puerto Rico in a general earthquake zone?
Puerto Rico does have an active seismicity in the area. Most of it occurs to the north of the island and off the coast quite a bit. So the earthquakes that do happen are felt or felt lightly. This one is on the southwest side and very near the coast in a couple of towns, so it hasn't felt quite strong.
Was Puerto Rico ready for this?
Puerto Rico is a seismically active area, so they do have some preparedness for earthquakes of the size, but you can only prepare so much.
What happens next?
Our primary mission is to locate earthquakes and provide the information as soon as possible up on our website or to the public as needed. Puerto Rico has its own seismic monitoring organization, and they are associated with us, so we get some of their data and share some of our data with them.
And what is that data used for?
That they use our data the same as we use theirs to help better locate the earthquakes in their region.
And why is that important? Why is it important to locate these earthquakes?
The main reason to locate them as precisely as possible is in order to figure out where the strongest damage or shaking may have occurred and to get rescue personnel or other officials to the area as soon as possible.
And where was that? In this case, where did the most damage occur?
It appears that most of the damage that has occurred for this earthquake is in the towns nearest to the epicenter along the coast. And they would be Waianae, which is about 10 miles away from the epicenter, and probably Ponce, a little less than 20 miles away from the epicenter. Those are the two largest towns nearest the epicenter.
Is there a 6.4? Is that enough to destroy buildings and wreck buildings and things?
It's enough to cause some significant damage. I know there has been one or two buildings that have collapsed, and I think they were more like houses or apartments over a parking garage or a small parking garage. So at least the photos that I've seen.
Now, what about a tsunami? Is there worry about that because this is on the coast?
Tsunamis occur immediately after the earthquake occurs, and usually you need at least a magnitude 7.0, and this is not anywhere near that. They would have felt it fairly strongly because of their proximity to the epicenter, but as far as causing a tsunami, you need something at least a 7, and that would only cause a minimal tsunami. Really, you need something a lot larger to cause a significantly damaging tsunami.
Does this tell us that there might be other earthquakes like this, or that there might not be for a long time because they had a big earthquake? Is there anything predictive about this?
No, we can't predict or forecast earthquakes, but when you do have a large earthquake like this, you will have aftershocks that go on for days and even weeks. But as time goes by, they will get smaller in number and smaller in magnitude, so they won't be felt as much. That said, they could still have some aftershocks in the magnitude 5 range that can cause additional damage to buildings that were damaged from the main shock.
Great. Anything you'd like to add? Anything we should know?
Well, people just need to be prepared to feel more aftershocks, and they probably should, if they have any damage to their buildings, they should make sure they have them checked out by somebody who's an engineer.
And that was John Bellini of the United States Geological Survey. Meanwhile, Florida's two GOP senators joined Puerto Rico's top official in Congress on Tuesday to ask President Trump for federal support following the earthquakes. Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott signed a letter with Resident Commissioner Jennifer Gonzalez Colon asking Trump to order agencies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to provide immediate assistance to Puerto Rico. The White House says the president has been briefed, but he's yet to call the governor. Trump has been at odds with the island Commonwealth since he was criticized for inaction after Hurricane Maria. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.